20 minutes, okay?
All right.
20 minutes, all
right? Yeah.
3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to the screening room. I'm John Tibbetts out at the Executive Inn. The screening room has moved north for today, and we're interviewing a very special guest, David Prowse, known to many of you out there as Darth Vader in the Star Wars saga. We'll talk all about that and the career of David Prowse, but first, these words. Can you hear the words now?
Yeah, I'm listening to every one of them. I'm just hanging on them.
3, 2, 1. Out at the Executive Inn in the screening room today, we're interviewing David Prowse. David, you're here on the occasion of something called Unicon.
That's right.
In your understanding, what is that all about?
Well, it's a science fiction convention for all the sci-fi enthusiasts. I mean, it covers science fiction, it covers all aspects of science fiction art, it covers the films, television, the whole works. And I've come here as a special guest to give a sort of presentation of my, basically to talk about my career and my association with the Star Wars movies.
Now, of course, we can assume that a lot of the people out here are really into this particular field, Star Wars specifically, but how many of them recognize you when you come down a corridor?
Oh, none at all. None at all. I have total anonymity. No, the thing is that having played the character in a mask, I really do have total anonymity when I want it. It's slightly different coming to science fiction conventions. Actually, I was going to say sci-fi, but by all accounts, sci-fi is now not a nice word. They like it all to be referred to as science fiction. So as they're coming to science fiction conventions, most people know me. So I can't walk around the hotel because everybody does know me. I mean, everybody that's here for the convention anyway.
If you really want to get a strange look, lay the word scientific fiction on the people sometimes. That's an old Gernsback term that doesn't mean anything anymore.
It's different at home because at home I'm the figurehead of the government's road safety campaign for children. And as such, I appear on television on a sort of regular basis.
And from your accent.
And from that I'm totally recognizable, and all the kids know and all the people know that Darth Vader is also this green cross code man, and I get recognized everywhere I go. But over here, it's completely different.
And of course, from your accent, our listeners by now have deduced that you are not from Kansas City
truly
or Chicago.
truly English.
Tell us about home. Where exactly?
Well, I was actually born in Bristol, which is about 130 miles west of London. But I now live just on the outskirts of London. I live about 9 miles south of London in a place called Croydon, which is sort of on the way to Brighton. But it's nice place.
David, I'm going to give you a chance to have a sip of that drink while I talk for just a second. The Star Wars saga has certainly been one of the most phenomenal success stories in the history of popular culture.
Right.
To be associated with that must be, in some ways, a real pleasure, and in other ways, maybe something possessing a lot of drawbacks.
I think if I was more visibly recognized from it, and had maybe a lot more of the things which are going for the ones that are recognized from it, then it would be a slightly different kettle of fish. I mean, I am obviously very excited to be associated with the two biggest box office movies of all time, and hopefully the third one, which we've already completed, which you'll see next May. I really am excited to be known as the ultimate screen villain of all time. It seems funny, here we are sat around the swimming pool and you're supposed to be talking to the ultimate screen villain of all time, you know.
It's a sign of the times.
But yeah.
Now, to be one of those men that you love to hate kind of thing,
yeah.
You know, that thing goes clear back to Von Stroheim.
Yeah.
Okay, you come to a convention like this. What single question is most often asked of you by the fans of the Star Wars things?
The thing you have to remember is that with Star Wars, the vast majority of... I mean, I get loads and loads and loads of correspondence, and I do a few science fiction conventions and things like this. And quite a lot of the talks I give are to children. Lots of kids turn up and things like this. So you get lots of what I call kids' questions. Things like, you know, how hot was it in the costume? How did they do the breathing? How did the lightsabers work? Probably that's the number one question: is how did the lightsabers work? Which is everybody all wants to know. How they actually worked in the actual filming stages.
And when the kids are able to get into the mechanics of these things, you don't find that they're at all, say, disillusioned
or
anything.
No,
like
not
that.
At all. No, I think I don't even think they're disillusioned about seeing me. In lots of cases, people advertise that Darth Vader is appearing, and although they say Darth Vader Dave Prowse is appearing, the kids still expect me to turn up in costume. And when I don't turn up in costume, they're not all that disappointed. You know, it's not a question of... so obviously, so with some very, very young kids, they get a bit disappointed and go home crying, and not having seen Darth Vader in drag. Or Dave Prowse in drag. they don't seem all that disappointed.
Well, I sometimes wonder...
Because I'm doing everything I possibly can, you see, is to let, the American public know who I am.
Well, I wonder if it's true if kids maybe aren't a little bit tougher about that sort of thing, because of television especially. We are behind the scenes all the time now with movies.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There's no secret about a lot of the special effects and things like that. And the fact that your voice is indeed not your voice on screen doesn't seem to be something that especially concerns you.
It did concern me. I mean, initially, but once having had it happen, as it were, I do the voice all the way through the picture,
right.
Because obviously I have to learn the dialogue and I have to deliver the lines so that all the other actors can react and do all those sorts of things. And it wasn't until the film was out in America, that Star Wars was actually out and showing, that I knew that they dubbed my voice. There was no sort of consultation. Nobody got in touch with me and said, look, this is what we're going to do. Very sorry, but we don't think your voice is suitable. I wasn't even given the opportunity of trying to do the voice. I mean, although I did the voice all the way through the picture, I mean, it was all done through the mask. And obviously, I mean, I realised that it wasn't going to be any good for reproduction purposes, but I would have thought... they would have turned around at the finish and said, well, you know, why don't, you know, we'll go into the studios and see if we can get the right voice. And if they couldn't get the right voice, then they could have turned around and said, well, look, sorry, Dave, but, you know, we're not getting what we want. We're going to look elsewhere. I mean, then I would have understood. But for them to have just, as I said, gone out of the blue and picked James Earl Jones to do the voice with no consultation with me, I thought was a bit off. I mean, it's something you have to live with now, of course. I mean, having done the voice on the first one, he's done the voice on the second one and will probably continue to do the voice of Darth Vader as long as Darth Vader survives the saga.
And let's face it, when you talk about voices, James Earl Jones, heavens. I mean, we're talking about one of the voices of the age.
Couldn't have chosen a better voice. I think what happened was that here they are with this huge black figure. And I think really they wanted a big black voice. And I think James Earl Jones was the obvious choice. I mean, and I think he's a lovely choice. I really do. I mean, I would love to meet the guy. I've never met him.
And especially, too, after the turn taken in the second film, where the big black menacing villain that we've been talking about, suddenly there's a note of sympathy injected here. Absolutely a bond now that's being established between him and Luke, or at least seemingly one.
Yeah.
And there's more rounded qualities coming into the character now.
The thing is you, with two films, you have two different directors, and each director sees the saga in a different light. I mean, you had George Lucas, who I always think of as a Stanley Kubrick type director, who regards the film as and the end product as the all important thing, and actors is what I call necessary appendages. Something you've got to have in a film. You've got to have actors. So whilst you've got to have them, you'll put up with them, as it were. You know. And Stanley Kubrick works like that. He's another of these fantastic directors who is an absolute genius, same as George Lucas, but who regards their art or their film art as their art towards the end product as being the big thing. And I think George Lucas, as I said, had. You know, had his 8 or 9 actors. You know,
it's also become in many ways his responsibility, hasn't it?
Of course. Oh yeah.
We're talking about a shaping influence.
But then of course you had Irving Kirshner came in, who's a completely different type of director and is more of an actor's director, and he sort of introduced all sorts of nuances into the situation.
That's what astounded me, David. Yeah. You think of films like Flim Flam Man and Luck of Ginger Coffee. I mean, here's a director who, as you said, very much interested in characterization, motivation.
Exactly.
And now suddenly he's dealing with a film that is almost 3/5 special effects, like the Earth is 3/5 water.
Yeah.
What a switch! And I think he did it remarkably. Yeah.
I think he did a remarkable job. I mean, he was marvelous actually, as far as working with me. You know, he'd come up with. I mean, when we did the first film, I mean, George Lucas. I never got any direction from George Lucas at all. Like, you know, there was never any question of me and George discussing it, saying, "Well, this is how I think you should play Darth, and this is what I think you should do." It was left to me completely, and everything that you saw in Star Wars was of my own volition. You know, when we came to when we came to do Empire, Irving came up to me and he said, "No, look," he said, "no, you're not going to move through this film quite as fast as you did through the first one." He said, "We're going to introduce a little subtlety into the character." And this is, he'd sit down with you and he'd say, "Well, now, Dave, this is a situation. You've just had a bad night." "No, seriously, it'll go like this." He said, "You've just had a bad night." He said, "The wife has kicked you out of bed," and he said, "And you've got to see the Emperor. The Emperor is not feeling too good either. He's pissed off with you." And he said, "And this is your attitude now as you go to meet the Emperor." He said, "I said, remember all this." I said, "And then go in and deliver your dialogue." And so he sort of sets the whole scene up for you.
I have this image of Darth wearing a torn T-shirt now after some of this, you know, yelling Stella or something. Let's get back and talk about your career that led you up to Darth Vader, and also what's going alongside in addition to Darth Vader. But we'll come right back after these words.
Words.
3, 2, 1. John Tibbetts back in the screening room. Actually, we're out at the Executive Inn here in Kansas City talking to David Prowse, better known, of course, as Darth Vader in Star Wars. David, as we've spoken, you are here in connection with the Unicon convention here in Kansas City. Now, the David Prowse that unfortunately some of us don't know too much about. And enlighten us now, if you would, some of your past career, what brought you into the role, and what are you trying to do in addition to Darth?
If I can take you right from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I originally... I came into the business in 1965. I had a career in bodybuilding and weightlifting. And
Certainly one can tell that, yes. This guy is taller than me when he's reclining. Anyway.
No, I was the British heavyweight weightlifting champion 62, 63, 64. Then I retired and went into professional Highland Games. I became the third best caber tosser in the world.
Third best
caber,
what?
Caber tosser, Scottish Highland Games, you know, where they throw that telegraph pole.
Good heavens.
And I became third best in the world at that. And then I really didn't know what to do with myself as far as work was concerned. At that time, I had a little company, and I was acting as an agent.
One can throw only so many telegraph poles, you know.
Telegraph poles, exactly, yeah. And I had to call on a stunt agency. And a stunt agency said, "Look, you know, if there was any work in show business, would you be interested?" Next thing I know, they've sent me up to the Mermaid Theatre for an audition for a play. And the play... was basically a three-hander, but they needed a fourth character to play the part of Death, and all Death had to do was to dress up in a black shroud, and it was almost like the original Darth Vader.
Is sounding very familiar.
To dress up in this black shroud and pick an actor up off the floor and carry him off the stage, waft him off the stage to make it look as though he was floating off, you see. But they'd auditioned lots of actors to do this job, and nobody could pick up this actor, you see, and he'd been dropped about 6 times. And so they hit on the idea of getting in touch with a strong man, and I went and did the job, and I picked him up and said, you know, "Where would you like him?" Like, you know, and they said, "Oh, that's marvellous, you know, can you do it twice nightly?" And that got me my union ticket. This is going back now, 1965. It got me my union ticket, and from there I went into doing TV commercials, and from TV commercial into TV series, and I did all the major TV series which came out of England, things like... I did Beverly Hillbillies. Beverly Hillbillies came over and did a few episodes over in England, which were absolute disasters, but I did them. I did The Avengers, I did The Saint, I did Department S, I did Jason King, Randlin Hopkirk, all these, you know, series which came out of England. And then I went from there into films. My first film was Casino Royale, where I played Frankenstein for the first time, and the monster. And then from then on, it became a succession of big heavies. You know, I was always the villain, I was always the monster, always the villain, always put in the picture to make the hero look good. And in fact, I have an autograph book which I take around to, you know, when I work. And I remember Roger Moore signed my autograph book after an episode of The Saint, which I did with him, and he put it in the bottom and said, to David, "Thanks for letting me win."
At that point, with a lot of television experience, then what?
Well, and it said then films really came about, and then I had a stroke of luck, in as much as the Hammer, who were doing all the horror films, we're looking for a new Frankenstein monster. And I went to see a guy called Jimmy Sangster, who was doing film called The Horror of Frankenstein, and got offered the part of the monster in the Frankenstein film. And that really opened up a whole new vista for me, because I became, you know, the automatic choice for Hammer's Frankenstein. And I did The Horror of Frankenstein, then I did a film called Vampire Circus, and I did another one called Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell. And the last one was a super one. The first one, the Jimmy Sangster one, wasn't all that brilliant. In fact, it got voted into the 10 worst horror films of all time.
Well,
I don't mean worst horrific, I mean worst. And then I had a couple of nice breaks, one of which was obviously doing Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange. I had another very nice one, which was I worked for Russ Meyer. Not the typical Russ Meyer films, or Russ Meyer, I don't know whether you call him Meyer or right. Meyer. But I did a marvellous film for him out in Barbados. And as I said, it's just been a succession of the parts getting better and better and better and better. And then along came Christmas of 75, and I get a phone call from George Lucas. And he'd obviously seen my work both on the Frankenstein films, and I think he'd also seen Clockwork Orange. And he came over casting for Star Wars. And I went to see him, and he said, well, I'm doing this film called Star Wars, and I'd like to offer you one of two parts. I thought, that's unusual, you know, like to offer me. And when he said, I'd like to offer you. And so I said, what are the parts in, George? And he said, well, the first part is a character called Chewbacca. And I said, what in the hell is Chewbacca? And he said, well, Chewbacca is like a hairy type gorilla that goes through the film on the side of the goodies.
It's hard to imagine a day and age when people can still say, who is Chewbacca?
Yeah, I know. And so I said, well, I don't fancy that very much, George, because all I could think of at the time was 3 months in a gorilla skin. And I thought, well, no, I don't fancy that very much. I said, what's the other part? And he said, well, the other part is a character called Darth Vader, who's the big villain of the film. And I said, don't say any more, George. I'll take the villain's part. And he said, well, tell me why. And I said, in my opinion, I said, of all the films that you ever see, where there's goodies and baddies, I said, it's always the baddie that you remember. I said, you remember people like Odd Job, and you remember Goldfinger, and you remember Jaws,
and
all these people.
And
yeah, and I said, but you don't necessarily who played the hero. And he said, well, I said, I think you've made a wise decision, because nobody will ever forget this villain. And of course, this is the result. You know, here we are now having completed my third one, because I've just finished work on Revenge of the Jedi, which is the third in the saga, or really a sixth in the saga. And I don't know whether you know or not, but George has written the Star Wars saga in 9 episodes, and we've just now completed the middle trilogy. Star Wars was 4, Empire Strikes Back was 5, Revenge of the Jedi 6. Now we're going to go back and do 1, 2, 3, and then 7, 8, 9.
And no, David, it used to be we only had to wait a week.
I know. Well, they're
coming
every 3 years.
That's 2 and 3 years.
It's now every 3 years. Yeah.
Well, now, while the Star Wars saga continues, and certainly it will, are there other opportunities now, quite apart from that, that you're able to proceed with?
For me, yeah, most definitely, because, you see, I've got involved back in England, the same time as the Star Wars thing happened. I became the figurehead of the government's road safety campaign for children. And our government in England, our Department of Transport, have a road safety code which they promote to the children, and it gets promoted in all the schools, and it gets promoted through booklets, and it gets promoted through parents and teachers and police and all this type of thing. And they hit on the idea of having a Superman type character to promote this road safety campaign around the country. And as luck would have it, the road safety campaign has become the most successful campaign which they've ever had. We've actually reduced the road accident figures in Great Britain by over a third. You know, since I've been this Green Cross Code Man character, they've gone down from 40,000 a year down to 25,000 a year, down to less than 25,000 a year. And twice a year, I do two-month tours of Great Britain, going around to all the schools. I do 3 schools a day, 4 cities a week, and an 8-week tour. And in fact, I go back, I'm going home on Monday, and I arrive home Monday morning, and on Monday night I have to be 150 miles away, to start my road safety tour on Tuesday morning.
That's incredible.
But it's marvelous, because it's because number one, you're doing some good. Number two, it gives me instant recognition, because you appear on these television commercials. And I don't know whether it's like it over here. I think it is, actually. If you make it big on television, everybody knows you. You can be the greatest film star. I mean, probably Ryan O'Neill could walk in here and nobody would probably recognize him. Because he's well known from the films.
That was why nobody recognized me when I came in.
But I'll bet you if somebody like Tom Selleck walked in here, he'd be mobbed. Everybody would fall over themselves to get to him, purely and simply because he is a big star who's made it through television.
So you're finding exposure in such diverse ways, then, aren't you? Really?
Well, now what's happened from that, in fact, is that I came over here last November, and whilst I came over to Washington to do some promotional work, because the other thing you find that is, as you become more successful and more well-known, all sorts of people get in touch with you to do various things, as you probably know. And I get a lot of charity requests and things like this. And so right at the very beginning, right at the very beginning, I said I would get involved with a couple of charities of my choice, and stop just there. So I got involved with the deaf children. I became the national defender for the country, and I'm the head of the Deaf Children's Association, and I go round. Or at least what happens is the Deaf Children's Society in Great Britain collects money to buy phonic hearing aids for deaf children, and when they've collected enough money to buy these aids, I go around and present the aids to the kids. You see, as this Green Cross Code man,
David. I don't know if you have a family of your
own. Oh, I have. Yeah, yeah.
One of the biggest.
I have.
Ones
yeah,
in
I know. I know.
Well, tell me about that. How many kids?
I got three. I got three of my own. I got a boy of 16 who's the same size as me. He's 16, he's 6'5" and weighs about 215 pounds at the moment. And then I've got a boy of 14 who's not quite so big, but he must be about 5'10", going on 6', and quite on the slender side. And I have a daughter who's already bigger than her mother, and her mother's 5'6", and so and she's 11. I have a marvelous family, and I'm just about to foster a girl as well. We're helping out with a young girl who's having some troubles, and we're taking on a fourth one, which. You know, it's going to be nice.
You're someone who is able to utilize the prestige position that you have to very good ends. It sounds like
I think this is something that I decided at the very beginning, is that all this thing which is happening to me, there must be a good side to it somewhere. There must be something that you can do with it. And as I said, I came over to Washington actually to. As I said, one of the things that I did last time I came to Washington was I got involved going around the deaf children. I went to visit all the deaf children's homes, and I went to see the mentally retarded and the physically disabled homes and things like this. And as a result of that, I got invited to come back and MC the annual general conference of the President's Committee on Employment of the Handicapped, which I did last week. And so that was marvellous, and I met some wonderful people. You know, all these 4,000 disabled people from all over America. It was a knockout. It really was a knockout.
David Prowse, our time is starting to run down. If I could ask you a final question, we know about your weightlifting background. Obviously, you are a very big man, but what about the choreography of the saber duels and things like that? Is this quite an involved sort of thing to work out in advance?
Well, on the first film, I'll tell you the truth. Actually, on the first film. I went sword fencing with Sir Alec Guinness for about 3 months before the film ever started, and we had to learn the choreography of the saber duel off heart. I mean, it was we knew every move that each other was going to do and things like this, and the same thing happened on the second film. When we actually came to filming the duel, they decided that some of the scenes, especially the ones up on the gantry, we're going to be too dangerous for me to do. You see, the thing is that actually, you know, the bigger you become in the film business, the more of an insurance liability you become. And so consequently, it's much easier to have a stuntman fall off the gantry than it is to have somebody like me fall off, and then you end up with big insurance claims and things like that. And so on the second film, on Empire Strikes Back, they brought in a guy who was the British fencing coach. And he, in fact, did some of the sword fighting for Darth Vader, exactly the same as he's done on the latest one. But it's. But I just think, as I said, if it lends to the picture, and gives you a much better overall result, then fine. You know, use him by all means. You know, I whilst I would like to have done the most of the sword fighting myself, I appreciate my limitations, and as I said, I'm quite certain that somebody like the British fencing coach can do it better than me.
Well, you know, this is another example of what we were talking about earlier. We can know about these things because we understand how. The mechanics of filmmaking have to function,
but
it doesn't impair the illusion
that's
up there on the screen.
No.
I think audiences are very savvy about that now.
I mean, same thing happened to Mark Hamill. I mean, he has a stuntman, obviously. I mean, because you can't expect Mark Hamill to do all those sorts of things and come out of it unscathed. And so, put the stuntman in.
We've been talking to David Prowse, Darth Vader, of course, in the Star Wars saga. David, I want to thank you very much for taking some time to talk with me here in the screening room. And one quick thing now. I've got several telegraph poles in my backyard I need to get rid of. Can you give me a hand?
You keep them. No, you keep them.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you more about Kansas City Entertainment next time here in the screening room. This is an addendum to the interview. This I'm going to be using in the article. Yeah. I'll tell you about my magazine later. All right. Now, David Prowse, you alluded just recently to to a role that just missed you, or you just missed it. Could you talk about that a minute?
Yeah, it was the role of Superman. I was working on Terry Gilliam's Jabberwocky. I don't know if you remember Jabberwocky. It was one of something like a Monty Python type film, and I was working on that at the time. And somebody came up to me. It was a very famous, very famous special effects man called Les Bowie, who did all the original special effects on Superman, and really terrific special effects man. Came up to me and he said, "Look," he said, "did you know that the Superman unit have moved into the studios?" You see, and I said, "No," I said, "I didn't know anything about this." So he said, "Well," he said, "I would suggest you get in quick and go over and see what they're doing about Superman." So I chased over to the offices, and I knocked at the door. You see, and I only knew one name on the production team, and that was a guy called Pierre Spengler. You see, and somebody had given me an introduction to Pierre Spengler. I'd never met the guy. And I knew that the other big noise was Ilya Salkin, you see. So I went over to the production office, knocked at the door, and this little guy with a tash answers the door. And I said, "Excuse me," I said, "I'd like to talk to somebody about Superman," you see. He said, "Well, do you want to see anybody in particular?" I said, "Well, I'd like to see Pierre Spengler," you see. So he said, "I'm very sorry, Pierre Spengler's away." He said, "Is there anybody else that you can see?" I said, "Well, I don't know anybody else." I said, "Ilya Salkin." You say, he said, "I'm Ilya Salkin." Oh. I thought, "Oh my God, that's ruined it, for a start." So he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to talk to somebody about playing Superman." And he said, "You mean you playing Superman?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, no way." So I said, "Well, what do you mean, no way?" I said, "I brought all my pictures. I'd like to show you all my photographs and things like this." And I got loads of pictures of me because I've done Superman in TV commercials and things. You say, and so I got all these photographs out and was showing him all these pictures. And he was looking at them, and he said, "Well, yeah, he said."
Well, Ilya Salkin is saying, "No way," while he's looking up at you.
Looking, because he's only about this high, yeah.
Interesting image there.
And he eventually turned around to me and he said, "Look," he said, you're obviously just what we're looking for, but," he said, "there's no way in which we can play you." So I said, "Well, I can't see why." I said, for what reason? And he said, "You're English as a star." I said, "Well, I can't see what difference that makes." He said, "Well, you wouldn't like it if we brought somebody over from America to play Winston Churchill, would you?" I said, "Well, I wouldn't mind." I said, "They never got a Jew in to play Christ, did they?"
What if Churchill's parents was American anyway?
Yeah, I know, yeah. And so I said, "Well, I'm sorry." I said, "But I still don't understand why not." And he said, "Look," he said, "the American public are going to account for about 80% of the revenue of the film." And he said, "And they just will not accept, especially sort of your Middle West people," he said, "they will not accept anything other than an American as Superman." So I thought, "Well, I'm not leaving it at that." So I managed to get an intro to Dick Donner, who was the director.
Yeah.
So I went to see Dick. I get a phone call from Dick Donner saying, "Can I go down and see him immediately?" And I thought, "Well, this is my big, big opportunity." So on went my navy blue suit, my Clark Kent suit, and on went my orange-rimmed glasses, chased down to the studio. And I was showing him my photographs. He said, "Dave," he said, "you're just what we're looking for." He said, "Perfect." He said, "Marvellous." Going through all these pictures that I've got. He said, "Of course," he said, "we can't use you." I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Well, we can't use you because you're not American." So that was that, you see. So the next thing was, an advertisement appears in the English newspaper saying, "Wanted, actor," it said, "actor, must be equity member, 6'6" to 6'7", 250 to 260 pounds, for the part of Superman. And they'd advertised in the papers, you see. So, chased down to the studios again.
Sort of flew down there.
Yeah, flew down there. And I said, "What's this?" I said, "There is nobody in Great Britain to whom this applies other than me." I said, "I'm the only 6'6" equity member who this applies to." And they said, "Oh, no, we definitely can't play you." So the next thing is, then I get turned down by the casting people. The casting director turns me down. And then eventually I get a phone call from Dick Donner again. He says, "Can you get down to the studios as quick as possible because we want to see you?" So I chased down to the studios and he said, "Well, we've got Superman." And I said, "Well, thank you very much." he said, no, not you. He said, we found this actor called Christopher Reeve in New York. And he's 6'5" and weighs about 175 pounds. I said, "How can you call that Superman?" I said, "He's positively skinny." And he said, "Well, yeah, this is the problem." He said, "We wonder whether you could train him for us and build him up." And I said, "Well, yeah, of course I can. I can help you put some weight on him," thinking that I was going to get quite a while to do it, you see. So I said, "Are there any provisos?" And I said, "How long have I got?" And they said, "Oh, there's lots of provisos. Number one, you mustn't give him any drugs. No, you mustn't give him any anabolic steroids or anything like that. Number two, all the weight has got to go on his arms, chest, and his shoulders. Number three, he's got to taper down from his chest to his waist, so we want a nice big V. Number four, he mustn't touch his legs. Now, if you're going to build anybody up, the first thing you do is give him leg exercises. And so
it's like a foundation to a house.
Yeah, so I wasn't allowed to touch his legs. And he said, and you've got 6 weeks to do it. I said, oh, you've got to be joking. And they said, no. They said, you've got six weeks to build him up for us. And so I had him for 6 weeks. He came to my gymnasium 5-6 days a week. I got in touch with various protein drink manufacturers and vitamin pill manufacturers and things like this, and shoved everything down him that I could possibly get down him. And I said, in 6 weeks, I put 30 pounds on him.
Now, anybody who gets involved in that learns real fast about pain.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things he said. It was very, very painful. He said, the initial first week's training. I mean, because we really had no time to get over the initial beginner stages. And I said his first week's training was very, very painful for him.
I just asked, was did Christopher Reeve able to maintain his body weight after you finished training with him?
Well, as far as I know, he hasn't. He maintained it for Superman 2, but with all the other roles that he's been playing. I don't think he really liked training. He was one of these guys who didn't like the sort of gymnasium atmosphere. I mean, he enjoyed working with me, and he enjoyed working with the various friends that we had in the gymnasium. But I don't think he likes the sort of the physical atmosphere that there is in gymnasiums. I think he'd much rather be doing other things like flying his planes and doing all those sorts of things.
Because I interviewed him recently for a death trap junket, and he talked about his glider a lot.
Yeah, he tells a great story, actually. He says that, he admits it was very, very hard work. Because not only did I train him at my gymnasium, I also set him up a gymnasium at the studio. And he said we had a great system, my coach and myself. He said, my coach says that I could eat anything I wanted. If it looked like protein and it didn't move, eat it. And that was basically the way we worked. I mean, it was I really shove everything down him that I could possibly get down him. All the eggs, meat, cheese, fish, poultry. But gallons of I got a special drink. I don't know whether you have it over here, called Nutriment. And it's a protein drink, and it's quite nice tasting. But he was drinking this by the caseload, you know. Normal people take it by the can.
When you're under the gun of time like that, do you concentrate more on isometrics, weights?
No. All heavy barbell work. All heavy barbell work, yeah. I'd train him as heavy as I possibly could and work him as hard as you can. It's really the intensity of work, you know, that you...
It's because we
were training for about 2 hours, 2 hours a session, 6 days a week, plus the odd bits and pieces he was doing when he was away from me.
Because when you start really getting in good shape and training like that, your appetite actually goes down. I mean,
increase. It should increase.
I mean, that would help, wouldn't it?
If it did. Oh, yeah, no, it has to. And then, I was giving him appetite stimulants and things like that to make him eat more.
Okay, one follow-up to that, then we'll go. The weight training, how important is that still in your life?
Oh, very, very important. I have a gymnasium. I have my own gymnasium. And I train all sorts of people there. You know, I have lots of famous people that train with me. I mean, I'm training the current Doctor Who. He's one of my clients at the present moment. I mean, I've trained the former Prime Minister of Great Britain. He was a client, Edward Heath. I used to train the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, go to and fro Saudi Arabia to train this guy. I've had lots of interesting clients, and it's for me, obviously, it's keeping in shape is very, very important, and because although I'm 46, I still play the big physical roles, and I want to go on playing them for quite a while. Yeah, and I think if I suddenly start letting myself go, I shall lose my little niche in show business.
Wow, let's face it, do that kind of concentration you're talking about also adds years to your life, too. And there can't be enough of, as far as I'm concerned. No. You're very, very nice to talk with, David.
Super.
And,
awesome.
I'll get this information into the interview as well. Thanks again. I just asked, was Christopher Reeve able to maintain his body weight after you finished training with him?
Well, as far as I know, he hasn't. He maintained it for Superman 2, but with all the other roles that he's been playing. I don't think he really liked training. He was one of these guys who didn't like the sort of gymnasium atmosphere. I mean, he enjoyed working with me, and he enjoyed working with the various friends that we had in the gymnasium. But I don't think he likes the sort of the physical atmosphere that there is in gymnasiums. I think he'd much rather be doing other things like flying his planes and doing all those sorts of things.
Because I interviewed him recently for a death trap junket, and he talked about his glider a lot.
Yeah, he tells a great story, actually. He says that, he admits it was very, very hard work. Because not only did I train him at my gymnasium, I also set him up a gymnasium at the studio. And he said we had a great system, my coach and myself. He said, my coach says that I could eat anything I wanted. If it looked like protein and it didn't move, eat it. And that was basically the way we worked. I mean, it was I really shove everything down him that I could possibly get down him. All the eggs, meat, cheese, fish, poultry. But gallons of I got a special drink. I don't know whether you have it over here, called Nutriment. And it's it's a protein drink, and it's quite nice tasting. But he was drinking this by the caseload. You know, normal people take it by the can.
When you're under the gun of time like that, do you concentrate more on isometrics, weights?
No, all heavy barbell work. All heavy barbell work, yeah. I'd train him as heavy as I possibly could and work him as hard as you can. It's really the intensity of work, you know, that you...
It's because
we were training for about 2 hours, 2 hours a session, 6 days a week, plus the odd bits and pieces he was doing when he was away from me.
Because when you start really getting in good shape and training like that, your appetite actually goes down.
Increase. It should increase.
That would help, wouldn't it?
It has to. And then I was giving him appetite stimulants and things like that to make him eat more.
Okay, one follow up to that, then we'll go. The weight training. How important is that still in your life?
Oh, very, very important. I have a gymnasium. I have my own gymnasium, and I train all sorts of people there. You know, I have lots of famous people that train with me. I mean, I'm training the current Doctor Who. He's one of my clients at the present moment. I mean, I've trained the former Prime Minister of Great Britain. He was a client, Edward Heath. I used to train the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, go to and fro Saudi Arabia to train this guy. I've had lots of interesting clients, and it's for me, obviously, is to keeping in shape is very, very important, and because although I'm 46, I still play the big physical roles, and I want to go on playing them for quite a while. Yeah, and I think if I suddenly start letting myself go, I shall lose my little niche in show business.
Wow, let's face it, that kind of concentration you're talking about also adds years to your life, too. And there can't be enough of them as far as I'm concerned. No. You're very, very nice to talk with, David.
Super.
I'll get this information into the interview as well. Thanks again.